Good evening. Who's our reader? You are, aren't you?
I am.
So we're doing the fifth of the sutras, working our way through the Majjhima Nikaya. 20 years from now.
And again, I sit without blemishes. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Savati in Jetta's Grove and at the Pandika's Park. There, the Venerable Sariputra addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Friends, bhikkhus," "Friend," they replied. The Venerable Sariputra said this, "Friends, there are these four kinds of persons found existing in the world. What for? Here, some person with a blemish does not understand it as it actually is thus. I have a blemish in myself. Here, some person with a blemish understands it as it actually is thus. I have a blemish in myself. Here, some person with no blemish does not understand it as it actually is thus. I have no blemish in myself. Here, some person with no blemish understands it as it actually is thus. I have no blemish in myself. Herein, the person with a blemish who does not understand it as it actually is thus, I have a blemish in myself, is called the inferior of these two persons with a blemish. Herein, the person with a blemish who understands it as it actually is thus, I have a blemish in myself, is called the superior of these two persons with a blemish. Herein, the person with no blemish, who does not understand it as it actually is thus, I have no blemish, is called the inferior of these two persons with no blemish. Herein, the person with no blemish, who understands it as it actually is thus, I have no blemish, is called the superior of these two persons with no blemish. When this was said, the Venerable Maha Moggallana asked the Venerable Sariputra, "Friend Sariputra, what is the cause and reason why of these two persons with a blemish, one is called the inferior man and one is called the superior man? What is the cause and reason why of these two persons with no blemish, one is called the inferior man, and one is called the superior man? Herein, friend, when a person with a blemish does not understand it as it actually is thus, I have a blemish in myself, it can be expected that he will not arouse zeal, make effort, or instigate energy to abandon that blemish, and that he will die with lust, hate, and delusion, with a blemish, with mind defiled. Suppose a bronze dish were brought from a shop or a smithy, covered with dirt and stains, and the owners neither used it nor had it cleaned or put away in a dusty corner. Would the bronze dish thus get more defiled and stained later on? Yes, friend. So too, friend, when a person with a blemish does not understand it as it actually is thus, I have a blemish in myself, it can be expected that he will die with mind defiled. Herein, when a person with a blemish understands it as it actually is thus, I have a blemish in myself, it can be expected that he will arouse zeal, make effort, and instigate energy to abandon that blemish, and that he will not die with lust.
And that
he will die without lust, hate, and delusion, without blemish, with mind undefiled. Suppose a bronze dish were brought from a shop or a smithy, covered with dirt and stains, and the owners used it and had it cleaned and did not put it in a dusty corner. Would the bronze dish thus get cleaner and brighter later on? Yes, friend. So too, friend, when a person with a blemish understands it as it actually is, thus I have a blemish in myself, it can be expected that he will die with mind undefiled. Herein, when a person with no blemish does not understand it, as it actually is thus, I have no blemish in myself, it can be expected that he will give attention to the sign of the beautiful, that by his doing so, lust will infect his mind, and that he will die with lust, hate, and delusion, with a blemish, with mind defiled. Suppose a bronze dish were brought from a shop or smithy, clean and bright, and the owners neither used it nor had it cleaned, but put it in a dusty corner. Would the bronze dish thus get more defiled and more stained later on? Yes, friend. So too, friend, when a person with no blemish does not understand it as it actually is, thus I have no blemish in myself, it can be expected that he will die with mind defiled. Herein, when a person with no blemish understands it as it actually is thus, I have no blemish in myself, it can be expected that he will not give attention to the sign of the beautiful, that by his not doing so, lust will not affect his mind, and that he will die without lust, hate, and delusion, without blemish, with mind undefiled. Suppose a bronze dish were brought from a shop or smithy, clean and bright, and the owners used it and had it cleaned and did not put it in a dusty corner. Would the bronze dish thus get cleaner and brighter later on? Yes, friend. So too, friend, when a person with no blemish understands it as it actually is thus, I have no blemish in myself, it can be expected that he will die with mind undefiled.
So I just want to pause here for a moment. You find this interesting?
Mm-hmm.
Why? Well, I heard you say, mm-hmm. How about you? Why?
I guess on some level I understand what he's saying. I couldn't reiterate it, I don't think. But
okay, but I want you to. So stumble through something. Why?
Okay.
I don't care. But
okay.
You know, make an effort here. I want to know, why is he doing this whole sutra kind of repeating something? What is it? What's the point?
When you recognize what is.
Yes.
You can do something with it.
Yes. Yes. Exactly. And furthermore, behind the lines, the state of full awakening is present all the time, continuously rises in your consciousness. But if you don't recognize it, you're not going to use it right. Furthermore, somebody said to the Buddha once, "What is Dharma?" He said, "When you're angry, do you know you're angry?" And he said, "Yeah." And the Buddha said, "That's Dharma." And he said, "When you're not angry, do you know you're not angry?" And the guy said, "Yeah." And he said, "That's Dharma." But we always think in terms of attainment, don't we? Mm-hmm. If I get to this place and I can just, you know, go to sleep and coast along. But no, the attainment is continuously happening. But to recognize it for what it is, that's the point. Is that what you're all hearing here?
Mm-hmm.
I hope you are.
Question.
Yeah.
I notice it's Theraputra talking, not the Buddha.
Yeah.
Is that common in me? I'm not
familiar. Quite common. Sariputra gave talks because he was known as a sharp, sharp mind. So that is to say, there were a bunch of them that were really excellent meditators who had attained, according to the Buddha's different descriptions in the different sutras, had attained arahatship. And he also had an awareness of detail, so he could explain it well. So quite a few of the sutras are by Sariputra.
And are they treated as if they were then by the Buddha?
Yeah, because they are from that same mind state and that same wisdom. And quite often the Buddha is sitting there. And then at the end he'll say, well said, Sariputra. Truly you have grasped the importance of this. And then all the bhikkhus were pleased. That's always usually written in.
Right. And these are recognized by Theravada.
This is right. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting, isn't it? And then there are also sutras by Mahamoggallana. And it's really interesting, by the time we've gone through all this, I think you'll have a better sense of how the Buddha actually taught. Sometimes people come up to him and he has them give the sutra, by the way he asks some questions. So they'll be going, well, ta-da-da-da, and he'll say, but would it not be if da-da-da, and they'll go, ta-da-da-da-da-da-da, and he'll say, oh, that's interesting, and if it was da-da. It's a much more broad base often than people think if they haven't actually read. It's a wide range of minds that are presented. But the point is always the same, that it is not the attaining of something that you're doing with Dharma. It's recognizing something. Which is why in the time of the Buddha, it was one of the really important meditations was jhana. Do you know what jhana is? Anybody doesn't know? Jhana is a state of absorption. You go deeper and deeper in a state of one-pointed mind or absorption. It's very blissful. And it can, depending on how you're counting them, there are four or five form jhanas. Jhana is where the consciousness is still operating in a form sphere, and four that are formless jhanas. That is to say, where the consciousness adverts to, using the word loosely, an object. The object of consciousness is not a form. It would be, for example, one is boundless space. So you would focus on space and then you would open the boundary. And consciousness totally gets absorbed in space to the exclusion of anything else being present. Mm-hmm.
So is a jhana different than the kind of absorption one has when, say, you're doing something you're really interested in, like gardening?
Usually that would be access, concentration, or first jhana. If it's really, really intense, it's first jhana.
So jhanas are something we're all really familiar with.
We're all, just like we're all familiar with full awakening, but we don't necessarily know it. And because in jhana the hindrances or the blemishes, or what is he calling them here?
Blemishes.
The blemishes in jhana, the blemishes are temporarily suspended. So you know what the mind without blemish is if you've practiced jhana. So that helps you identify it when it happens during the day. As long as you think it's something you haven't experienced, like the, you're not going to recognize it. Are you? If you don't know how to name it properly, you're not going to recognize it by that name. So that is also, to me, very clearly being stated in this sutra, like the need to actually know what is without blemish, so that you can differentiate, because he's not saying just a happy state. He's not saying jhana, per se. He's saying to be able to recognize when, you know, when you're angry, do you know you're angry? When you're not angry, do you know you're not angry? To be able to clearly recognize the state that exists. But very rarely do we actually recognize the state we're in, do we? Usually the last thing we recognize is the state we're in. When it's built into something with some energy, then we recognize that I'm tired, I'm in love, I'm pissed off, you know? I'm bored. I'm uneasy. All those. But we don't usually recognize that state until it has gotten to the point where we actually claim it as a position or a possession, ourselves as an object. But that's not Dharma. Dharma is not focused on inherent self. It's impermanent, it's dissatisfactoriness, and it's no inherent self. Those three things. So it is a very profound thing, actually, that he's saying here, that to actually see things as they are. A neat trick, if one can do it, you know. And you can do it if you're like not too busy, can't you? If you're out in the country or, you know, gardening, or, you know, there are periods of time. But there often too, in those times, you try not to see what you are, don't you? Because you kind of like to stay in the. Am I the only one? No, two of us. Two of us in this room kind of like to stay in that state. The rest of them are. Superior. Superior beings. You're going to ask a question?
Yeah, it almost seems as though he's suggesting that to be aware is more important than to be without blemish. Like
That's exactly what he's saying. That's exactly what he's saying. That's exactly what he's saying. Because if you're aware, then you're not trying to cover anything up. And that points directly to sila, to morality. Morality means you're willing to be present with what is present. And you can't do that unless your confidence is not based on whether you are loved or not. If your confidence is based on seeing things as they are, you can do that. And it is such a switch for us to move the mind off of a performance or, you know, objects, you know, positions and possessions is usually the way I like to sum it up. I'm sure I'm leaving some stuff out of there, but it's kind of, you know, positions and possessions. As long as one is identifying with a position or a possession, like, well, I am somebody who never gets angry, or, you know, like that, then they're not going to see Dharma. They're not going to see whether there's a blemish or not a blemish. And seeing whether there's a blemish or not a blemish is alive. You're present. You're here. You're not holding a barrier between you and life. Therefore, you're powerful. To actually see things as they are is a powerful state of mind. A powerful state of mind is an ethical state of mind. Because not trying to change anything. Just take a corner off here, move. The tailor's scissors aren't out, you know. One.
What do you think about hope in that? I know it's sort of a leap.
That one should know when there is hope present. That's really it. You mean hoping for a condition? But if you're hoping, you're not going to be able to see the awakening that is.
Yeah, that's... Yeah.
So my beloved teacher, Namjab Rinpoche, he said to me many years ago, for some reason, I really don't know why he said that to me, but, you know, Cecily, if a child is crying and crying for a piece of cake, he has to shut up and stop crying and look before he can eat the cake that's in front of him. And that's like hope, you know, like really wanting, I hope, oh.
Yeah.
Versus like, well, what is present is this cake. And maybe the cake is always in front of us. And maybe a hope distracts us from that. I know that it was quite astounding for me many moons ago to discover that in Buddhism the closest thing to a sin was becoming. The desire for becoming, the desire for becoming, because it removes you from the present. And it's back again to the same thing that his sutra is talking about, like actually being able to identify what is. So, do you mind going on? I just wanted to kind of underline this. I think
it
would be easy to miss it.
The connection in the third kind of person, when a person with no blemish does not understand it as it actually is thus, this will lead to lust infecting his mind and he will die with lust, hate.
And so is that where it says the sign of what line are you on?
Page 109, the start of 6.
But
I don't see the connection.
No blemish does not understand it as because he does because the consciousness is. Yeah, okay, it's exactly the same thing as I was saying, but this is like very powerful. Thank you. This is a very powerful statement. A lot of the training in Buddhism is to recognize what is already there. It is not to attain something, but to recognize what is already there. If you do not recognize it, then pretty soon you just walk right over it and a lot of the training in Buddhism is to recognize what is already there. And that means that the mind has to be aware of detail and be aware of different states. Most of us, when we start to meditate, we want a particular thing which we call good. I have a friend who has developed prostate cancer. He's been meditating on his own for years and years and years, never likes talking to anybody about his meditation, because he figured out probably about 20 years ago how to meditate so that he shut his mind away from everything. And that's his fervent desire, you know, his sense of wanting to be peaceful. But what he is calling peace could be called cancer. Because he wants things to stop. You know, that's really what he wants. If you talk to him for a little while, you really get that really quickly. He wants things to stop. Do we do that? Anybody in this room do that? Sort of like equate peace with anesthesia? Yeah. They aren't quite the same thing though, are they? Yeah. So, like, to actually know what peace is, to know it, That's the one you're saying, with no blemish. And if you don't understand it as it actually is, then the next thing that happens, you're going to maybe you're actually enjoying that no blemish mind, but something will arise and the no blemish mind will pass. Some sense, some noise will arise, and the wind of anger will come up or something, and you won't recognize the anger as anger. So therefore, you won't know that the anger is just a wind, and the mind of no blemish is where you need to keep your focus. So you won't be working knowing the mind of no blemish. I understand it this way. The original mind is pure. It is underneath everything. Every once in a while, you see it. Every once in a while, you don't. Sometimes, really hard to see. Like my living room floor, you know?
Jeez, you got a lot of books in there.
Like my living room floor, right? It's like, what floor? Then when you see it and you walk across it, you don't even think about it. And so then you don't know what is floor, what it is, what its value is. So you don't know the difference between floor and not floor. Right?
So you're always searching for the floor that's right there, but...
In Buddhism, the original mind is pure. In Buddhism, you are never separated from nirvana. In Buddhism, most of the training is to learn to recognize a state that you have never left. Get your eyes off the defilements. You know, and the defiled mind. Quit thinking that the defiled mind is going to satisfy you, because it isn't. So the only way you can do that is know the defiled mind for the defiled mind, and know the undefiled mind for the undefiled mind. So the Buddha said, you know, when you're angry, do you know you're angry? Yeah. That's Dharma. That is Dharma. That is truth. That is law. That is Buddha Dharma. That is the truth that leads to total understanding. Knowing the state you are in. Not trying to become something else. It's slippery though, isn't it? It's so simple. It's another one. Ananda said to the Buddha, "Oh, Lord Buddha, this teaching is so simple." And the Buddha said, "Oh, say not so, Ananda, say not so." And then, you know, a few months later, Ananda says to the Buddha, "Oh, Lord Buddha, this teaching is so profound and complex." And then, and the Buddha said, "Say not so, Ananda, say not so." That's very beautiful, that verse, isn't it?
Yeah, because it's a lot easier to see anger or frustration, or, but in a way, at least for me, it's harder to see the calm.
Which is why, like I said, which is why it was very common for the Buddha to take a bunch of the guys and women off in the forest and sit them down and teach jhana. So they would recognize different states of depth of being consciousness without blemish. And some people, he wouldn't do that, because they needed more to learn how to see the states of anger or lust as empty. They didn't need this experience, they needed this experience. So what he would do with them is take them off to the forest and teach them to do the meditation on previous lives. See the streaming of cause and effect, you know? So this is arising, but it's empty of inherent existence. It's based on, you know, the butterfly at the equator beating his wings. And are we not all connected?
Yes.
So there, ha ha ha, can't get away again. It's your fault. I'm your fault. I mean, I don't have to do. No, no. And you know, like, I mean, a lot of that isn't taught, is it? You know, Jack, I mean, when I listen to people studying Buddhism, I don't very often hear the kind of range. You'll see this in these sutras. I hope these sutras get very interesting to you. You will see in these sutras, you will see him like on, you know, with the bhikkhus out here, and they're all doing this meditation, and or that one. And the range that was taught, the type of consciousness that was necessary to develop. Because you have to switch your mind from position and possession to energy, to flow. And when you see the flow, then you see anicca, dukkha, anatta, no problem. But then the mind flips back, doesn't it? Blemish comes in. That's the first mara, the stopping of the mind, you know. The four maras, the first one, stops the mind. As soon as there is a stopping of the flow, the mind is stopped. As soon as it's not energy, but position or possession, then you're not practicing Dharma, according to this. Or you're an inferior poison.
This is the cause and reason why these two persons with a blemish, one is called the inferior man and one is called the superior man. This is the cause and reason why of these two persons with no blemish, one is called the inferior man and one is called the superior man.
So that's a summary of everything that's gone before. That's the reason why. Because one will get dirtier if you don't recognize it and one won't. If you recognize it. Okay?
Blemish is said, friend.
Isn't that great? And just see us. It's going somewhere. Oh, blemish. Whole new word. Springing back into existence.
Blemish.
110? 8, 9, 110, 9. Okay? Yeah.
Blemish is said, friend, but what is this word blemish a term for? Blemish, friend, is a term for the spheres of evil, unwholesome wishes. It is possible that a bhikkhu here might wish, if I commit an offense, let the bhikkhus not know that I have committed an offense. And it is possible that the bhikkhus come to know that the bhikkhu has committed an offense. So he is angry and bitter thus. The bhikkhus know I have committed an offense. The anger and bitterness are both a blemish. It is possible...
And just want to... I don't know what the word is that's being... translated in a nine in evil unwholesome wishes, but I would assume that what they're talking about is a defiled mind state accompanied with consciousness, like consciously wishing that.
Yeah. Like,
I think that's what he's calling a blemish.
Like
where you consciously say, I don't want anybody to know I made this mistake. Mm-hmm. I think that's why he's used the word evil there in 9. I don't know this, but it's my assumption. Okay? So we're on 11 now? It is possible that a bhikkhu here might wish, I have committed an offense. The bhikkhus should admonish me in private, not in the midst of the sangha. And it is possible that the bhikkhus admonish that bhikkhu in the midst of the sangha, not in private. So he is angry and bitter thus. The bhikkhus admonish me in the midst of the sangha, not in private. The anger and bitterness are both a blemish. It is possible that a bhikkhu here might wish, I have committed an offense. A person who is my equal should admonish me, not a person who is not my equal. And it is possible that a person not his equal admonishes him, not a person his equal. And so he is angry and bitter thus. A person not my equal admonishes me, not a person my equal. The anger and bitterness are both a blemish. It is possible that a bhikkhu here might wish, oh, that the teacher might teach the Dharma to the bhikkhus by asking a series of questions of me, not of some other bhikkhu.
Because I want to give the discourse. You're so brilliant. But somebody never asked me.
And it is possible that the teacher teaches the Dharma to the bhikkhus by asking a series of questions of some other bhikkhu. Not of that bhikkhu.
Damn.
So he is angry and bitter thus. The teacher teaches the Dharma to the bhikkhus by asking a series of questions of some other bhikkhu, not of me. The anger and bitterness are both a blemish. It is possible that a bhikkhu here might wish, oh, that the bhikkhus might enter the village for alms, putting me in the forefront, not some other bhikkhu.
The elders or the senior, you know, the senior or the most respected monks always led the alms round.
And it is possible that the bhikkhus enter the village for alms, putting some other bhikkhu in the forefront, not that bhikkhu. And so he is angry and bitter thus. The bhikkhus enter the village for alms, putting some other bhikkhu in the forefront, not me. The anger and bitterness are both a blemish. It is possible that a bhikkhu here might wish, oh, that I might get the best seat, the best water, the best alms food in the refectory, not some other bhikkhu. And it is possible that some other bhikkhu gets the best seat. It is possible that a bhikkhu here might wish, oh, that I might give the blessing in the refectory after the meal, not some other bhikkhu. And it is possible that some other bhikkhu gives the blessing. It is possible that a bhikkhu here might wish, oh, that I might teach the Dhamma to the bhikkhus, that I might teach the Dhamma to the bhikkhunis, men lay followers, women lay followers, visiting the monastery, not some other bhikkhu. And it is possible that some other bhikkhu teaches the Dhamma. It is possible that a bhikkhu here might wish, oh, that the bhikkhunis, men lay followers, women lay followers, might honor, respect, revere, and venerate me, not some other bhikkhu. And it is possible that they honor some other bhikkhu. It is possible that a bhikkhu here might wish, oh, that I might be the one to get a superior robe, superior alms food, a superior resting place, superior medicinal requisites, not some other bhikkhu. And it is possible that some other bhikkhu is the one to get superior medicinal requisites, not that bhikkhu. So he is angry and bitter thus. Another bhikkhu is the one to get superior medicinal requisites, not me. The anger and the bitterness are both a blemish. Blemish, friend, is a term for the spheres of these evil, unwholesome wishes. It is the spheres of these evil, unwholesome wishes If the spheres of these evil, unwholesome wishes are seen and heard to be unabandoned in any bhikkhu, then for all he may be a forest dweller, a frequenter of remote abodes, an alms food eater, a house-to-house seeker, a refuse rag wearer, a wearer of rough robes, still his fellows in the holy life do not honor, respect, revere, and venerate him. Why is that? Because the spheres of these evil, unwholesome wishes are seen and heard to be unabandoned in that venerable one. Suppose a bronze dish were brought from a shop or a smithy clean and bright, and the owners put the carcass of a snake or a dog or a human being in it, and covering it with another bowl went back to the market. Then people seeing it said, "What is that you are carrying about like a treasure?" Then raising the lid and uncovering it, they look in, and as soon as they saw, they were inspired with such loathing, repugnance, and disgust that even those who were hungry would not want to eat, not to speak of those who were full. So too, if the spheres of these evil, unwholesome wishes are seen and heard to be unabandoned in any bhikkhu, then for all he may be a forest dweller, unabandoned in that venerable one. If the spheres of these evil, unwholesome wishes are seen and heard to be abandoned in any bhikkhu, then for all he may wait, then for all he may be a village dweller, an acceptor of invitations, a wearer of robes given him by householders, yet his fellows in the holy life honor, respect, revere, and venerate him. Why is that? Because the spheres of these evil, unwholesome wishes are seen and heard to be abandoned in that venerable one.
Now, this is basically a lay person who is so clear in his practice of Dharma that the whole neighborhood treats him like an ordained person. And his clothing and everything is supplied for him by the neighborhood, which is basically what somebody who is an ordained person is supposed to be living like. But this is someone who just automatically springs up because of his excellent practice of Dharma. So you can see by that was actually common in the time of the Buddha. There were people like that. You didn't have to, take refuge this way or that way or the other to be able to practice Dharma.
Suppose a bronze dish were brought from a shop or a smithy, clean and bright, and the owners put clean boiled rice and various soups and sauces into it, and covering it with another bowl went back to the market. Then people seeing it said, "What is that you are carrying about like a treasure?" Then raising the lid and uncovering it, they looked in, and as soon as they saw, they were inspired with such liking, appetite, and relish that even those who were full would want to eat, not to speak of those who were hungry. So too, friend, if the spheres of these evil, unwholesome wishes are seen and heard to be abandoned in any bhikkhu, then for all he may be a village dweller, abandoned in that venerable one. When this was said, the venerable Maha Moggallana said to the venerable Sariputra, "A simile occurs to me, friend Sariputra." "State it, friend Moggallana." "On one occasion, friend, I was living at the hill fort at Rajagaha. Then, when it was morning, I dressed, and taking my bowl and outer robe, I went into Rajagaha for alms. Now, on that occasion, Samiti, the cartwright's son, was planning a fellow."
Planing
a fellow.
It's like something like, doing renovations on a house or something. Mm-hmm.
Planing a fellow.
It's a kind of tree.
And the Ajavika is a negation. Oh, all of you might like to know, you see those little lines over the vowels? That means that vowel is pronounced like a long vowel. So that would ajivaka. Ajivaka. And jiva is life. Jiva is the power of life, the life force, life essence. So this would be, his name would mean, Ajivaka, would probably have to do with going beyond the life essence, that name, something like that. Okay.
And the Ajivaka Pandaputta, son of a former Cartwright, was standing by. Then this thought arose in the Ajivaka Pandaputta's mind. Oh, that this Samiti, the Cartwright son, might plane this bend, this twist, this fault out of the fellow, so that that it would be without bends, twists, or faults, and come to consist purely of heartwood. And just as this thought came to pass in his mind, so did Samiti, the Cartwright's son, plane that bend, that twist, that fault out of the fellow. Then the Ajivaka Pandaputta, son of a former Cartwright, was glad, and he voiced his gladness thus. He planes just as if he knew my heart with his heart. So too, friend, there are persons who are faithless and have gone forth from the home life into homelessness, not out of faith, but seeking a livelihood, who are fraudulent, deceitful, treacherous, haughty, hollow, personally vain, rough-tongued, loose-spoken, unguarded in their sense faculties, immoderate in eating, undevoted to wakefulness, unconcerned with recluseship, not greatly respectful of training, luxurious, careless, leaders in backsliding, neglectful of seclusion, lazy, wanting in energy, unmindful, not fully aware, unconcentrated, with straying minds, devoid of wisdom, drivelers. The Venerable Sariputta, with his discourse on the Dhamma, planes out their faults just as if he knew my heart with his heart. But there are clansmen who have gone forth out of faith from the home life into homelessness, who are not fraudulent, deceitful, treacherous, haughty, hollow, personally vain, rough-tongued or loose-spoken, who are guarded in their sense faculties, moderate in their eating, devoted to wakefulness, concerned with recluseship, greatly respectful of training, not luxurious or careless, who are keen to avoid backsliding, leaders in seclusion, energetic, resolute, established in mindfulness, fully aware, concentrated, with unified minds possessing wisdom, not dribblers. These, on hearing the Venerable Sariputta's discourse on the Dhamma, drink it in and eat it as it were by word and thought. Good it is. So too there are clansmen who have gone forth out of faith, not drivelers. These, on hearing the Venerable Sariputta's discourse on the Dhamma, drink it in and eat it as it were by word and thought. Good indeed it is that he makes his fellows in the holy life emerge from the unwholesome and establish themselves in the wholesome. Thus it was that these two great beings rejoiced in each other's good words.
Do you have any questions, answers, comments, complaints?
I haven't experienced hunger today. But we you're talking about earlier in the same, always to attain something rather than recognizing its presence. I heard it a crash and I knew there'd been an accident, so I went down to the corner. And when I was sitting there, there was two people, and I started to make an aspiration, but what I recognized, it was really interesting, because at the moment I started to make the aspiration, it had been completed. Yeah. It was like this enormous Vajrasattva over this accident scene, but there was no details to go through to get there. It was like, started the aspiration, boom, it's complete.
Mm-hmm.
Like you were saying, things are they're already there. There isn't like
that's
this.
Right. But turning your mind to it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It was there, and now that, but I didn't recognize it in the same way as now I do, seeing it in the light of this.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, you know, it's like that.
Very clear, isn't it?
Yeah.
Thank you.
So I'm clear. It seems like this sutra starts off saying what's really important is to be aware of whether there's blemishes or not blemishes. And then it kind of goes through that and says, but it's really better not to have blemishes.
It doesn't say, I didn't hear it anywhere saying it's better not to have blemishes. I heard it saying the only important thing is to be aware of what is present. Where do you see it says important? Are you thinking it infers that?
Well, I guess all the parts that
it certainly says that if you're aware of the blemishes and you will do something, they will be removed.
Yeah, and I guess all the
whereas if you're not aware, they won't be. Is that what you mean?
Well, but also, you know, if the spheres of these evil unwholesome wishes are seen and heard to be abandoned in any bhikkhu, then, you know, for whatever reason, that's good. You know, they'll be respected, revered, and venerated. Why? Because the spheres of these unwholesome wishes are seen and heard to be abandoned in that venerable one.
Right.
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 So that seems to be the.
Yeah,
but that comes after.
That's right. Jack is on page 112-29. But you notice, Jack, in the sutra, that comes after a whole long list of the different kinds of offenses that are blemishes, of like trying not to be aware of what is present, and all the different ways one could do that. Right? And before that, it's mentioned that the whole dialogue about the pot that is clean or not clean, and that if you don't know which it is, you don't treat it appropriately. So having established the sense of the appropriate, from my reading of it, what it points at is on page 29 with at page 112 with 29 is that so long as consciousness is trying to change what is, then it's making it's like obliterating your own possibility for happiness. That's more the point to me.
Okay, maybe it's the term unabandoned.
Because when you actually see yourself holding your thumb in the door and slamming the door, you abandon that. But it isn't that it's an effort. It's the awareness that is the effort. Why is my thumb hurting? <laughs> You know? <laughs> Oh! And then as soon as you see why suffering is arising, it isn't automatically abandoned. And again, that's such a powerful discernment in the Buddhist teaching, that the consciousness will go for the pleasurable. You heard His Holiness the Dalai Lama talk about that all the time. All beings desire happiness. And in all through the Buddhist teaching, in every school of Buddhism that I have studied, there's always that clear understanding that if you see something that causes greater suffering, there's a really good chance that pretty soon you're not going to be doing it. But it's the seeing that is the key. So does that change the influence, the inference a little for you?
Yeah, I mean, probably have to think it through.
So that if some, because if somebody sees the position as important, I have to keep my thumb here when I close the door. Then other people will see them doing that and decide not to close doors that way. But they'll still be doing it, right? So, and so he will continuously be focused on the position of his thumb rather than the letting go of suffering. I'm using that analogy.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. And I guess I'm kind of sorting whether it's the to me, it seems to have shifted a bit to, from kind of awareness to content, but I've got to kind of sort of, you know, I'll read it again and see what
it's happens. Slippery too, yeah. Isn't it? It is a very slippery thing. We do that. We actually think that there's something we have to stop, but according to the Buddha, that's for a beginner. You know, if you really are being a mass murderer, then yeah, you take the vows and you jack them up all the time and you get somebody to come around and knock on your door after 10 o'clock to make sure you're not out howling at the moon, you know? Yeah. But then as you see the benefit of that, you don't need that.
See, I think that point's really clear in the first, you know, 10 or 15 verses.
Right.
And then it kind of goes at it another way. And I'm just, you know, that's what... Oh. I, yeah.
Oh.
You know, like, I thought that was really clear, right? You know, like the first page or so. Then this thing more about, you know, it's good to be aware of it, but it's really good not to have them. So, but that's just... You know,
I understand what he's saying, because he's saying, in the first part it's saying, you know, be aware of if it's a blemish or there's no blemish, know the difference, right? And then it's saying, as I understand, this is a blemish, this is a blemish, this is a blemish. It's describing what's a blemish, and it's talking about unabandoned. So you may be thinking, like, well, what's the connection? How are you abandoning it? Then it's as though you have to abandon it. But I think he's saying to be aware of it. If you're aware of it as a blemish, are you going to act on it?
Yeah.
No, and that's what you're saying.
Yeah.
You're not going to act on it if you see it as a blemish.
Yeah.
If you see it as a need, like an imperative, an ego imperative like he's describing, you won't see it as a blemish, so you'll act on it. So it's almost as though he's saying to be aware of it as a blemish is not to actually act on it, is to abandon it, isn't it?
As soon as you are aware of it, you will. Mm-hmm. According to the Buddhist teaching and according to my experience, as soon as I really see that I am holding my thumb in that door and shutting the door,
yeah,
I will move my thumb. As soon as I make that connection, that when I do this, this is suffering. Which is why I tell myself a lot of stories about some things that I don't want to stop. That is to say, I don't want to see them too clearly.
Yeah. It's a good question, right? Because these arise a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, they do. You know, these types
absolutely
of thoughts.
Absolutely.
So if you're seeing, well, they shouldn't be there, so it's wrong, that's a struggle, that is a problem, right?
Whereas, like, just turn your awareness, oh, this is a mind with blemish. Mm-hmm. Then you're not focused out there, you're not trying to change the world, you hadn't made it deeper. I think probably I'm looking at them more from that angle because I'm so familiar with the four stages of Mara, you know, the four Maras. The first one is stops the mind. And the second one is called the Mara of aggregates. And Salter Malione calls it the mind that run, the Mara that runs on and on. But it develops aggregates. It develops like form, feeling, sensation, mental formations, and consciousness, but in a very crude kind of way. There starts to be, you know, a build-up of ways you can see it, ways to collect evidence on it. You know, first is like desire. Desire, that stops the mind. Or anger, that stops the mind. There's anger and there's an object. And then there starts to be kind of a story about it, and then you collect evidence, and you know how you do that. And it goes forever, right? And then you've got evidence afterward. Then you go to bed at night, and you go to sleep, and as you're going to sleep, you're thinking, I'm just going to... And then they... And after that... But I wouldn't have... But they... And then you dream about it, and then you wake up in the morning... Get more evidence, right? So it exactly is, and the mind goes on and on. Whereas if you just see it at the beginning, that, oh, here is the mind stopping. Mm-hmm. You know, oh, here is the mind caught in jealousy about somebody else getting what I think I want. You know, then, and am I, do I find jealousy so satisfied? Does that really turn me on? No. Then immediately it just shifts. Or it won't immediately shift out, but then you've got the tool that you just keep applying and then it will shift out. Just because you're aware of it and you're just seeing it directly for what it is, then... It is in the West, in all the mystical schools, they talk about the individual soul coming merging into totality again, and that's exactly the same language here, where insight enters totality rather than partiality. The mind of knowing knows and doesn't separate, but uses the knowing to come into totality. Or, you know, the sunlight and the mother light, or, you know, how many, there's as many ways as you want to name it. Basically, the state of blissful calm at union, at one-ment, and the knowing of that state, and the training oneself to have like a greater and greater ability to know that state without getting picky about details, one way or the other, like trying to take a few extra little valises in with you, or, you know. It is true. The state you are in is the state. It is true. And so knowing that and knowing the table, and there's no war, that's abandonment. But what you're abandoning is the focus that there's something that should be changed. And opening to totality. So it's both it's an abandoning in that it's a surrender of becoming, basically. Surrender the desire for becoming. But let the desire just be there, just the object of, you know, desire without object. Don't change the nature of the desire, change the nature of object. You know, the carrot in front of the dog, you just cut the string. Or make everything a carrot, or nothing a carrot. Or...
Duh.
Hmm. this a situation possibly arises where you, if you're meditating on the breath, you come to a state where you feel great equanimity and calmness. And the sense that you're connected with an awareness that is pervading everything in the stillness. When you come out of it, you no longer have to look. You no longer expect anything outside you to make you happy.
Mm-hmm. It's called turning about in the seat of consciousness. Do you remember that phrase?
Mm-hmm.
It's called turning about because no longer are you going outer. You know where the light is.
And
usually you have to practice that for a while, practice remembering it. Yeah, one does have to practice remembering it, but when it occurs, it's called turning about in the seat of consciousness, and it's very quiet and very profound. It changes the consciousness, but one does have to practice it, practice remembering it in a funny kind of way. Although that sounds totally contradictory, I think it's true. Good. That's a good description of it, isn't it? Turning about in the seat of consciousness. It's a bit flowery, but... yeah. It no longer the outer is not going to hold the key. Exactly.
You don't expect anything from your side to
Yeah, so that the consciousness is turned around in its seat. It's not looking out anymore.
You can enjoy it, but you're not having the
expectations from
it. It's
fine. Fine. It's just fine.
If you forget to practice it, you can slip into a sloth and torpor.
Yeah, you can, or you go around telling everybody about your experience, which is always fun too, or, you know. I mean, there's 1,001 ways to... Well, maybe not 1,001. How many does he list there? Starting on page 110 there. Blemish is said, friend, but what is this word blemish a term for? You know, there's lots of ways that we do it, you know, that we don't practice it. But now you know what that state is, so then one has to practice it.
Keeping the friendship going.
Keep the friendship going. Indeed. Indeed.
I have a question about becoming. I've noticed how the mind always wants to grasp at an identity. I'm quite interested in this right now, how there's a strong impulse to continuously...
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it is so powerful.
Mm.
It's worse if you've got the kind of will that you think you should get. It's worse. And all of us, in something, have that kind of will. Mm. We should, like, you know, whether it's the will for self... destruction, or whether it's the will for suffering more than anybody else on the block, or, you know, but all
or
of
even
us...
more subtle, like, it's also like to become a Buddha, or to become a nun.
Yeah, there's nothing more subtle about any of them, believe me. Honestly, they're not.
Yeah.
None of them are more subtle than any other. But that, and that's exactly what one has to do with it. It's just know that it's occurring. Mm-hmm. And that starts the mind turning around in the seat of consciousness. Mm-hmm. It isn't that you can't have all of them. So then there is that feeling of, yeah, but I want them. Does that make sense to you?
Well, there's certainly an impulse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so then...
to grasp at that again.
Yeah, so then you know that the view that what you've got again, always the two things, the conflict of emotion and the primitive view hooked together. The view is, if I get that, right? So then, and it's based on an emotional, the emotion is with it, they're hooked together. So at that point, what one can do with that, there are two main ways to approach it. One is to see what is the history of this view. Basically, in our language, what we would call the therapy approach. Mm-hmm. Although therapy doesn't take it quite exactly the same way that Buddhism does. Basically, what I was saying about going and doing meditations on previous lives. Or doing meditation on cause and effect somehow or other. Tracing, nothing arises without cause. Tracing cause. So that one can see over and over and over again achieving that in every possible form and it not working. Still, the desire comes up. There was always something wrong with it in retrospect, you know. And then that man walked downstairs wearing a green scarf instead of an orange one, and even though I wasn't looking out the window, it just spoiled the vibration in the whole neighborhood when I was getting it. Did I ever tell you about the first time I was going to awaken? I don't know if I ever told you.
No, I don't.
It's quite wonderful. It just, like, epitomizes this. I think it was my third retreat. And this was at the Dharma Center of Canada when there were still the mink sheds up. Those were the early days. It was a mink farm before we bought it, and it had a slaughterhouse and the sheds for the mink. So the teacher at that time was this skinny guy named Ananda Bodhi, Venerable Ananda Bodhi. We used to call him the Bhik, Bhikkhu, you know, the Bhik. And the Bhik told me that I should meditate in one of the mink sheds. Well, the one thing you could say about that was it wouldn't be crowded. Because nobody else, everybody, whoever else might be assigned to a mink shed would have found a way out of it. So, okay, I was going to be in the mink sheds. And that was, he had just had us start making robes in those days. So we had to sew these elaborate robes, I think because his sensibilities were offended by watching us all sit, because we used to sit also together in the house, and I think his sensibilities were offended by how badly we all sat, so the robes were voluminous, and they covered many sins, and we had lots of pillows, you know. I did anyway. With 9 pillows in my robes, I could look pretty good as a meditator. So I had my 9 pillows, my robes, and I was in the mink shed. And I'd been to, you know, classes for, well, probably more than a year. It was my third retreat, so I figured, well, get this awakening thing over with, you know. It's like an hour and a half before lunch, so.
Other things to do.
Robes are looking good. Yeah, oh, maybe I could just fix the cushions, okay. Okay. An hour before lunch, that's good. The robes aren't quite right. I know I've tied this wrong, okay. Oh, now I gotta fix 3/4 of an hour before lunch. You get the picture, it goes on. It's like maybe 10 minutes before lunch. I got 10 minutes to awaken here. And I'm like serious, like I'm seriously going to awaken here. I got it all right, you know. I'm balanced in a reasonable posture. Well, I don't have both
feet on opposite, but, you know, my tongue curled back. Our chin's tucked in, and, you know, I've got it all. I mean, bleh. And I got my hands and thumbs and slightly in the armpit. And got it. Yeah. And I'm sitting there, and I'm watching the book, and I'm watching my nose, and I resist the temptation to check in my notebook to see what I'm supposed to put more focus on, the gap between the in-breath and the out-breath. I resist that because I know that would just be doubt. And I'm focused. And I'm really focused. And I'm really watching the breath. And this little chipmunk comes up and sits in my hands and looks up. I'm going, fuck off. So that was the first time I was going to awaken. There are many variations on that over the years. Many variations. Yeah. Where the aim overwhelms the present. This Marge Piercy's poem, Living in the Open, you know. To hear your voice over the subway roar of my needs requires discipline. Ouch. And that's what becoming does. It takes you out of the present. So you can do it two ways. You can go look in the past and see, like, cause and effect in the past, and see how many times, how many things were there, and then there was dissatisfactoriness arising immediately afterward. And then you have a greater understanding of what is meant by dukkha. Or you can image it into the future. You can image yourself being satisfied with that or having it. And do like a Salter Meleone's beautiful exercise of feeding the demons, like continuously feed that, say, okay, you've got it, okay, it's yours. You can go either way, past or future. Some people, they work better in the future. There's a lot of cynicism in our culture about working with the past. Especially, you know, did any of you actually read Other Lives, Other Selves? Can I see a show of hands here? It's getting better.
Oh.
What?
The books are in it. It's in the bookstores. I'll pick them up tomorrow.
Okay. Oh, there you go. Some more of you will have read it by tomorrow. By Saturday.
Yeah, that's because tomorrow, yeah.
Does it require reading for this week?
I recommended this book, 4 months ago? Mm-hmm. Strongly. And also 3 months ago and 2 months ago. This one.
Who's it by?
Jungian, British Jungian, named Roger Wolger, is that right? Wolger. And he's an interesting, you know, it's an interesting book, not because it's brilliantly written, not because his presentation is flawless, because if you actually persevere a little bit through the first two or three chapters and really read the book, I have never read a description of sankhara that so viscerally helps understanding of what that term really is.
What's that term?
Sankhara.
What's that mean? I don't know.
Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankhara, Vijnana, you know, the five aggregates.
Sankhara is...
mental formations, usually. Oh, sometimes right. Sometimes called right. Mental formations, although it's not a good translation.
Mm, I've never.
Yeah, and that book is, I think, is like a powerful. Those of you who have read it, do you find that there was a real clear grasp of, oh, that's sankhara.
All right.
And in our culture in particular, we don't look that way. It's like there's a dimension missing from how we see. And it's that same dimension that would come from looking at previous lives or future lives. You could work it either way. That gives a way of allowing becoming but not being enslaved by it.
Right, because that was my other question was, I mean, the creativity of the mind is also compassionate, right?
It is the tool. I mean, that's the tool, the ability to name what you want and go after pleasure. That's how you awaken. When you understand that it's more pleasurable to not suffer than to suffer, then you drop the states that create suffering. Right? That's the path and the result, both together. So to be able to take something like becoming and aim it for what you really want, not have it drag you. Is the horse riding the rider? Is the rider riding the horse? You know? That's what it comes down to. And if you can't name it, and if you don't understand it, and if you don't know the difference between the horse and the rider, then the horse is going to ride the rider, quite often.
Yeah, I've noticed there's a freedom in the underlying state, right? Like awareness, let's say, that I realize, I mean, just something has happened for me where, you know, often when our life, things don't happen the way we expect them to, there's that experience of groundlessness, right? Mm-hmm. Some people find negative, but actually it's really interesting because then you see that we're living under concepts of who we are and
exactly.
Where our life is going.
Exactly.
And the freedom is very pleasurable. And what's interesting to me is that the mind still grasps to figure out, but who am I going to be? Who am I? Where am I going? What's to fix the future?
Yeah,
that to me seems like the becoming. It seems.
Is
like
it the past is a lie and the future is questionable?
There's a desire to fix it, though.
Yeah.
Right. To say this is the way it's going to be for the next 20 years.
Yeah.
I'm planning it now. Right.
Yeah.
Isn't there?
For many people.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people ask me how long I'm going to stay in Didsbury.
Yeah.
I've been asked that a lot in the last year, especially since March.
Yeah.
So are you going to stay there? So what are you going to do now? Well, I thought I'd have a sip of water. Oh, that's not what you want to know, is it? I don't know. I guess I'll age some more. I've been doing that pretty steadily for the last little while, so I guess that trend will continue.
Yeah.
There are some things you can be sure you're going to achieve. For example, death. It is our career choice. It is the career choice that every one of us is going to get to. And that's useful for keeping the rest of the charade under control, too. But believing that you can actually attain something is what makes it so addictive. Because that feels so satisfying in the mind. Doesn't it? The belief, the satisfaction is a mental satisfaction. Absolutely. So if you look at past attainments and realize how before you achieved them, they had mental satisfaction. And when you achieved them, it's like, that. Why didn't that stay satisfied? So if you look at, you know, the causes and how consciousness has gone through cause and effect, and understand the drive of sankhara, then you're not so caught by the addiction. You can actually use that power in a different way. But it's a continuous dance. So.
So, Sully, did the Buddha ever say it's possible to cease becoming?
He said there's no longer subject, one is no longer subject to becoming.
But he never said that there is no longer becoming.
There is no longer self. What's the difference, Pat? It's not becoming that has to cease. It's the subject.
Something like having thoughts or being held by thoughts. The thought in my head, do I want it there or not, or am I going to permit it to be there? How should I explore it? Should I go and do any exercises of right perception? But can you reach a stage where you're not subject to...
Where it's just a thought.
No, no.
You see it as a thought. And you know what thought is.
Yes.
So there's no I subject to the thought. I does not exist in relation to events.
Yes, right.
My sweet mama said to me many, many years ago, you know, I feel like the only thing I've ever done in my life was be born. Ever since then, I've been reacting.
Mm-hmm.
That's what my sweet mama said to me, Morris. The only thing I did in my life was be born. Ever since then, I've been reacting. That's what she said. Never mind whether she was right or wrong about birth. Just very interesting. She's a very interesting woman. Ever since, I've been reacting. The sense of self is defined in reaction, in relationship. So how can there be consciousness without relationship? That's an interesting question. That's the question. See, that's the question.
In the West, the prevailing view is it's impossible.
Jeez. Must be time for a new view.
It's a very social view, right? That it's all in language, it comes out of language and social relations.
There's a very strong belief that conditions are real in the West.
Yeah.
Another way of saying that would be, say, this is a very materialistic society.
Yeah.
According to Buddhism, there are 8 knowledges that bridge between materialist view of reality and totality view of reality. The first one of those is a really interesting one. It is knowledge of, what's the word that's used? Knowledge of supernormal consciousness. Knowledge of other than material existence.
Mm-hmm.
Knowledge of it. Not, oh yeah, I believe in it.
Mm-hmm. The experience of it.
The clear knowing experience that of the flowing energy of existence rather than the thingness of it.
Yeah.
That's the first one. As long as one is looking for goals and aims and hands to rub one's ear balls, one will probably find them. I mean, then that will be the focus of the consciousness, so that you miss the energy flow.
Yeah. What do you think?
That's so interesting, isn't it? I find that, you know, first time I read that, read Eight Kinds of Supernormal Power, it's called. The first one is Knowledge of Supernormal Power.
Yeah.
And the first time I read that, I thought, well, like, of which supernormal power? Normal power? Eh? Okay, is it a... But knowledge of supernormal power. Knowledge of that. Not believing that, yeah, who's going to pay the taxes is the only real reality. Not being a tree hugger because you're in revolt. There are plants in here. And you could chew them. Nobody would probably stop you because we're also involved in Dharma talks. See, that's right. There's one. You could chew that one really good. He's so predictable. Oh, he didn't. He didn't. He wasn't predictable. He wants both the hand and the chewing of the plant. Oh, 3 minutes after union time. There's a beautiful gold light in your hearts, spreads through your body. Pours out your pores in all directions, above, below, in front, behind, right, left, four quarters. Wherever there's suffering due to ignorance of body, speech, or mind, anyone you want to pray for, just image them. That light just washes through and the suffering is temporarily assuaged. You think whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there's less suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there's less suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there's less suffering. Thank you for your great compassion. Thank you so much. Thank you.